Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ira Melman reporting. Charleston, South Carolina continues to reel in the wake of a mass church shooting. Charleston is still in shock, reeling from a crime that captured the world's attention, a white gunman shooting and killing nine people, all African Americans, at a Bible study class at an historic church there. The young man who allegedly pulled the trigger is in prison, facing nine charges of murder. VOA religion correspondent Jerome Sokolowski reports from the scene in Charleston.
Charleston is normally a lovely place to visit. It's known as the Holy City precisely because of churches like this one. But the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church is the oldest black church in the South.
Never. In a million years. Never.
Marlene Coakley Jenkins still can't believe it happened here or that her sister was among the victims.
Our message to our community, our home community, is we appreciate all the love and support. But truly speaking, we didn't expect any less because the people here are like the climate. We're warm, we're caring, we're loving.
This church has meant so much to the struggle for an America free of racial hatred. And now it's a tragic reminder that that struggle is not completely over. Jerome Sokolowski, VOA News, Charleston, South Carolina.
South Korea says no new cases of Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, MERS, were reported Saturday, thus raising the hopes the country is winning the battle against the deadly virus. So far, 24 people have died from MERS in South Korea. 166 have been sickened by that virus, which cannot be controlled by any known vaccine. More than 6,700 people who may have been in contact with someone have been quarantined. This is VOA News. Saturday is World Refugee Day. The United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, says in a new report that the number of people fleeing their homes for safety rose more than 8 million over the previous year. UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Antonio Guterres, said we're witnessing a paradigm change, an unchecked slide into an era in which the scale of global force displacement as well as the response required is now clearly dwarfing anything seen before.
We have reached a moment of truth. World stability is falling apart, leaving a wake of displacement on an unprecedented scale. And global powers have become either passive observers or distant players in the conflicts driving so many innocent civilians from their homes.
The UN says the plethora of the world's crises and conflicts has provoked a dangerous and worsening trend in irregular migration as millions of refugees around the world are pushed into an uncomfortable and deadly dynamic with human traffickers and smugglers as they seek passage to safety. The European Central Bank has agreed to increase emergency funding for Greek banks after their customers withdrew more than $4 billion over the past week. The additional ECB funding is reported to be up to $3.4 billion to keep Greek banks afloat only until Monday. That's when more funds may be needed, and as finance ministers of 19 Eurozone countries are expected to meet in Brussels. Contacted by VOA by phone, an ECB official neither confirmed nor denied the so-called emergency liquidity assistance, saying it's the bank's policy not to comment on financial transactions with other banks, in the present case with the Greek banks. The new ECB funding is a last-minute effort to strike a cash for reform deal with Athens. Economic powers outside the Eurozone are following the situation with growing alarm. An Afghan family returning to their home after fleeing a possible military operation struck a roadside bomb Saturday in the country's south, killing at least 12 of them and wounding 8, according to authorities. The blast struck the family's van in Helmand province's Marjah district, largely a Taliban stronghold. At least 12 died in the blast, though the death toll could rise, according to the provincial police chief there. The family fled the district in recent days after hearing a government offensive could take place there. According to a relative, the relative said the death toll likely was higher as he believed as many as 21 of his relatives had been killed in that blast. The death toll from drinking tainted liquor in a Mumbai slum has climbed to 84. It is the worst incident of its kind in more than a decade, according to police in that Indian city. I'm Ira Melman in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
This year is particularly alarming because the number of refugees is almost 60 million, which is a 16% rise on the year before.
Today is World Refugee Day as the UN Refugee Agency warns of sharp increases in the number of refugees worldwide.
We are signatories to the Rome Statute and we have legislation in South Africa which says that we will abide by the rulings and the decisions of the International Criminal Court.
The South African Parliament plans to begin debate on the controversy surrounding the refusal of the government to prevent Sudanese President Bashir from leaving the country despite a court ruling.
Even the broadcasters, the content providers are raising issues. Unfortunately, in Uganda, nobody fights for these rights except us human rights activists.
And Uganda completes the switch from analog to digital television that leaves some citizens without television signals. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Nigerian military has responded to recent allegations by Amnesty International that accused the army of gross human rights violations and extrajudicial killings. This as the military combat Islamist militant group Boko Haram. One for more, military spokesman Colonel Sani Kukashika Usman joins us live via telephone link from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Good evening, Colonel Usman.
Good evening, Peter. How are you doing?
I'm well, thank you. And how are you?
I'm okay.
Now, Colonel, tell me, what is the army's reaction to the accusations of human rights violations and extrajudicial killings by the Amnesty International?
Well, you know, it is not just the army, but it is the Nigerian military. We are really concerned about the Amnesty International report leveling allegations of gross violation of human rights and extrajudicial killing by the Nigerian military. And to put the record straight, there was a need for us to respond accordingly. And one thing Amnesty International does not understand is that there is no way the Nigerian military, who has the constitutional responsibility to defend the territorial integrity of the nation, will go out of its way to massacre civilians in cold blood. And if you look at the allegations, the present allegation, which was released on the 3rd of this month, is not different with the previous allegation, except that the figures have changed and now they have gone an extra mile to cut a call on the government to prosecute some military officers, both serving and retired.
Now, will the military at least begin an inquiry into some of these allegations made, and how thorough will this investigation be?
You know, it's no question of beginning. There have been ongoing investigations since their previous allegations. And I can tell you that the defense headquarters already set up two joint investigation teams to investigate and screen, as well as categorize suspected insurgents in detention. And out of 504 suspects screened, a case has been established against 350 who had been forwarded to or recommended for trial at the Federal High Court. Right now, their case file is with the Attorney General and at the Minister of Justice, I must say. And apart from that, you know, there was a time also Amnesty International gave out a 5-point questionnaire to the Nigerian military, and we responded accordingly. And they also gave a 37-questionnaire to the Nigerian military on the 23rd of December 2014, which was responded barely within 24 hours. And no reference was made to that. And they expect us to respond to all their queries within the twinkle of an eye when it took them about 4 or 5 years to compile their own report. So invariably what I'm trying to say is that we have always been responding accordingly to allegations of human rights violations by any of our personnel. And appropriate disciplinary measures are being taken. It's just so unfortunate they don't take cognizance of those facts.
Well, let me ask you, talking about the fight against the terrorists, as you said, or Boko Haram Islamist militants, how is the joint effort of these nations in the fight against Boko Haram, as well as the Nigeria's military pressure on the militants?
Yeah, the fight is going on and is yielding the desired results. And of course, the level of cooperation we are enjoying with our neighborhood, I mean, with our northern countries, is really, really improving with each passing day. More so now that a multinational joint task force has been created once again and invigorated, which will come on stream by the end of next month, hopefully. And believe me, the fight is going on fine, and the cooperation is really good, and it's helping the fight against terrorism, not only in Nigeria, but also in the sub-region.
Now, briefly, tell me about the search for the Chibok girls. Any news about that? Are you gathering intelligence that will help in the possible, being freed from these militants?
Yeah, we maintain that hope. And we are still gathering information or intelligence, as you said. We are hoping and praying that we will get to that, and hopefully they will be rescued.
Now, talking about gathering intelligence, how is the cooperation with ordinary citizens in terms of giving the military actionable intelligence to work on it?
Yeah, so far, so good. The civilian populace are beginning to understand and realize that they are equal stakeholders in the fight against terrorism, and they have been cooperating fully. For instance, the recaptured town of Baga, they form a kind of vigilante group that really assists the military. Not only that, there are other areas like Pulka and Goza and so many other places, and even in the city of Maiduguri. People volunteered and they are assisting. And honestly, it's helping a lot.
Thank you very much. Colonel Sani Kukashika Usman is a Nigerian military spokesman. He spoke with us from the capital, Abuja. Today is World Refugee Day, and the United Nations Refugee Agency, or UNHCR, says in a new report that a record number of people, about 59.5 million people compared to the 51.2 million from the previous year, have been forced to flee their homes in search of safety. Leo Dobbs, a spokesman for the UNHCR, told me earlier that there is need for a political solution to help resolve the circumstances that force people to become refugees.
Well, World Refugee Day is the one time when we can put a spotlight on refugees and other people who have been forcibly displaced by war and persecution. And we can remind the world of their suffering all over the world.
Now, we're talking about approximately 60 million people who have been displaced around the world. How are some of these situations arising, and how is UNHCR coping with the situation?
Well, that's right. This year is particularly alarming because the number of refugees is almost 60 million, which is a 16% rise on the year before. And these are figures for 2014. So the 2014 figure of 60 million was 16% higher than the figures for the year before, and 60% higher for the figure 10 years before. So what we're seeing is a staggering increase in the numbers of conflict which are driving people from home. In the past 5 years, and it's accelerating. These conflicts are accelerating, and in some ways, the world just seems to have gone wild.
Does that mean that with the recent migrants who have died on the Mediterranean, among other issues, the expectation is that there could be more refugees?
Well, I mean, all the signs at the moment are that this problem is not going away. And that's the message that we at UNHCR and our High Commissioner have been taking to the world in these today and this week, is that there have been 15 conflicts that have started or been reignited around the world in the past 5 years. And the numbers just keep on going up. We have crisis after crisis. This year we've had new crisis in Yemen. We've had people continuing to flee from Myanmar and Bangladesh across the Bay of Bengal. There just seems to be no end in sight. And there's a worry that we've reached almost a moment of truth. And if we don't do anything collectively in the world, that this problem is just going to get out of control, which it's going that way at the moment.
What possible challenge does this pose to the UNHCR, especially in terms of resources, organization, and taking care of these refugees?
Yes, well, I mean, you know, we are one of many organizations that are trying to help the victims of these wars. And but we're finding, because there's so many crises, that there's not enough resources to go around. And we're finding ourselves, you know, unable to pick up the pieces. And so what we're advocating is that we take a close look, a real hard look, and look for radically different answers to the problems. Otherwise, it's just going to get worse.
Is there a possible move to have the world richest countries or these countries to recommit themselves to helping to reduce this conflict that ultimately produce all these refugees?
Well, I mean, the only answer to these problems is a political answer. So, I mean, we're just there to help the victims, as I mentioned earlier. But, you know, there really needs to, countries have to, will need to recommit themselves to ending, to trying to end wars. They must recommit themselves they must renew their commitment to the 1951 UN Convention. There must be another look at the ways of humanitarian aid are distributed and raised. There must be a real sort of thinking outside the box in many ways. I mean, this is just, we've never been in such a situation. And so, you know, for unprecedented measures are needed at a time for this unprecedented displacement.
Leo Dobbs is a spokesman for UNHCR. He spoke with me from Geneva, Switzerland. Libyan officials suspect there could be up to 1 million illegal immigrants in the north of the country, some working, but most planning or hoping to board smugglers' boats for the perilous sea crossing to Italy. The officials say Libya, which is ensnared in civil conflict itself, can't cope, and viewers saw for itself this week the inadequacy of detention centres in the Libyan capital, Tripoli. For VOA, Jamie Detmar has the details.
Collins, a 30-year-old Ghanaian, is in tears when he talks to me in a noisy and crowded detention centre in the Libyan capital of Tripoli.
They gave us food. I want to go back to Ghana. I love my country. I just came to raise enough money to go and start my business. I was into construction business. I was renting out scaffold and tools and equipment. But just to come here, gather some money, and to enlarge my business.
He's squatting under the scorching Libyan sun in the centre's yard with about 300 other illegal immigrants caught by Libyan police or militias either trying to reach Europe aboard people smuggling boats or working illegally in this strife-torn North African country. The guards order the men and boys to bow their heads, but when they hear VOA questioning why, they shout at the detainees to look up. One guard pokes them with a stick, but throws it away when a colleague whispers in his ear. Richard, a 28-year-old Ghanaian, a plasterer, says,
"We are praying that they can do something, that they can free us. If they are not freeing us, they can take us back to our country so that we can get our freedom. Okay. Because we are here, we are suffering too much. The pain is too much."
The guards at this small detention centre on Tripoli's airport road are mainly militiamen, untrained to cope with migrants, and it shows. They're doing the best they can, but lack of training, the potential threat of violence from the desperate migrants, and utterly inadequate and insanitary conditions are all making their job harder. The centre's director, Maloud Juma Salim, says the migrants come from nearly every sub-Saharan African nation. He sees me saddened by the tale of woe coming from the migrants. None, though, accuse the guards of mistreatment. He says, I should remember that some of these men are criminals. Last night, he says, they tried to break out through a window to escape. These people cause many problems, he says. Libyan detention centres are bulging with such migrants whose dreams of a better life in Europe are dashed. Jamie Detmar for VOA News, Tripoli.
A prominent South African opposition lawmaker says President Jacob Zuma's government flouted the constitution by refusing to carry out a court order that sought to prevent Sudanese President Omar Hassan al-Bashir from leaving the country. This as South Africa's parliament plans to open a debate on Tuesday about the administration's refusal to prevent President Bashir from leaving the country. Parliamentarian Jordan Lewis from the Opposition Democratic Alliance told me that the party will demand answers from the government.
I wouldn't call it a faux pas, however. I would call it an absolute disgrace and a trampling on South Africa's constitution. South Africa is a constitutional democracy that believes in the rule of law and equal and fair treatment before the law. So when we are signatories to the Rome Statute and we have legislation in South Africa which says that we will abide by the rulings and the decisions of the International Criminal Court, then we are bound by that law to implement the arrest warrants of the International Criminal Court, whether we agree with them or not. That is the nature of the law. That is the nature of the court. So to allow Omar al-Bashir, who is a murderer and a dictator and a thug, to escape South Africa without being arrested and quite possibly with the assistance of the South African government is an absolute disgrace. And it actually puts South Africa in something of a constitutional crisis.
Which government official will be present on Tuesday? Because we understand that President Zuma's presence in parliament was disrupted by an opposition group, the EFCC. Do you think he will come again based on what transpired, or another government official will be in attendance for some of these questions to be raised?
The president does not have a very good track record of accounting for anything. And so I don't think that the president himself will come and account. The president's modus operandi is to avoid any tough questions on any controversial issue which puts him in a bad light. So I expect that the deputy president will come to account in that debate, or perhaps the Minister of Home Affairs. Remember, the Minister of Home Affairs is responsible for all of South Africa's borders. And so actually he was the minister responsible for ensuring that the court order was adhered to. And when the court order was not adhered to, it's ultimately him that must explain why his customs officials at the South African border post let Mr. Bashir out of the country.
We understand that South Africa has an agreement with the African Union before it hosted the recent African Union summit, ensure that immunity of all heads of state and government is guaranteed. And thereby, the political agreement overshadowed the domestic issue or the obligation of the South Africa to the International Criminal Court as a state party. What do you say to supporters of the ANC who say that they have to respect the obligation of the African Union heads of state and government?
No. The agreement reached at the African Union was illegal and therefore completely illegitimate. South Africa is a signatory to the Rome Statute, and we have domestic legislation called the International Criminal Court Act, which binds us to the decisions and the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court. So to reach a decision at the African Union, which was a political decision, has no legal standing or legitimacy. The government should never have offered that guarantee. It was not entitled to offer that guarantee, and in fact, it was illegal to offer that guarantee. And so that political agreement has no standing.
So what's next for the Democratic Alliance on the subject?
Well, what's next is the debate in Parliament next week, Tuesday. But it certainly doesn't end there. There's many, many months of investigation and explanation that the government will have to do to get out of this one. And so the DA will be driving it all the way and making sure that every single aspect of this very, very serious scandal is followed up with.
Jordan Lewis is a South African parliamentarian from the Opposition Democratic Alliance. He spoke with me from the capital, Pretoria. This week, Uganda completed the switch from analog to digital television. Broadcasters were ordered to switch off the analog transmissions, leaving many television consumers who had not transitioned from their old analog television sets with no TV. Uganda is one of many African countries which committed to digital migration by June 2015. But now some are accusing the Uganda Communications Commission of acting arbitrarily and imposing an unjustifiable deadline. Isaac Samakadi is the chief executive officer of Legal Brain Trust, a Kampala-based human rights watchdog. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached him in the Ugandan capital to find out the effects of the switch.
People are saddened by the development. It appears that a lot more people than had been previously imagined are suffering the effects of the blackout. It has even reached the floor of Parliament, and I think that will be the first business since Parliament has just come from recess. Monday next is going to be the second sitting, and I think that will be an issue.
I see. You're quoted as saying this move was unlawful. How so?
Particularly because there is a gap in the regulatory framework. When the Uganda Communications Commission received the 2006 Geneva Agreement of the International Telecommunications Commission, particularly the Regional Radio Conference, it did not take any steps to domesticate the agreement locally. So whereas the Uganda Communications Commission is mandated to ensure compliance with international treaties, communications treaties to which Uganda is a state party, it is also required to regulate the sector using statutory instruments which have been gazetted, which have been published in the Uganda Gazette, which have been laid before Parliament for discussion and approved. And it's required to make consultations with the minister. In fact, the minister is the one supposed to sign such a regulation. So the Uganda Communications Commission, time and again, makes regulatory pronouncements without paying heed to the requirements of the rule of law, which include following the proper procedures before you make pronouncements that are intended to have legislative effects. So in that regard, there was no appropriate digital migration legislation which was discussed in Parliament, upon which the public was consulted.
Now, you say Parliament may address this issue next week. In the event that that doesn't happen or nothing comes out of that, do you have any legal recourse to take, or what's the way forward then?
We did attempt to file an application in the High Court of Mbale, and I was informed by my lawyers that it was rejected, that the judge found it to be very controversial. So hence we had to resort to a court wider than the courtroom, which is a public court. But earlier, on the 5th of May, we had filed applications for access to information, a dozen of them, through our communications chief, asking the Uganda Communications Commission to give us information on the progress of the report, of the project, because we wanted to know how many people have successfully completed the transition. We wanted to know how many people will suffer if this deadline is not extended. UCC did not provide any information. Now, even the broadcasters, the content providers, are raising issues. Unfortunately, in Uganda, nobody fights for these rights, except us human rights activists.
So, if I understand you correctly, you're saying now this may depend on the people themselves raising their concerns. Is that correct?
Yeah. We don't think a legal action may be viable right now for those reasons I've told you. So, it has to be left to the office of the citizen.
Isaac Samakade is the CEO of Legal Brains Trust, a Kampala-based human rights watchdog. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from the Ugandan capital. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. And then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. Right now it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy what we have for you today.
Johnny, Johnny Bo, question. If I know see my Donnie,
American, I wonder the way you want your body, give me thunder. Girl, I can follow you bumper to bumper. Girl, I can follow you bumper to fender. Oh, baby, you're wireless. Girl, I promise to be your defender. Girl, I can love you January to December. Girl, let them hate her, them back to sender. Oh, baby, you're wireless. Oh, baby, you're wireless. Oh, baby, you make me grace. Oh, baby, you make me grace. Girl, I've been loving you every day. Girl, I'm loving you every day. Let nothing come out.
I want your body sleeping in my bed. I want your body sleeping in my bed. You got me going crazy. Oh, girl, I can't explain it. Your body's so insane. Oh, girl, I can't replace you. You got me going crazy. Oh, girl, I can't explain it. Your body's so insane. Oh, girl, I can't replace you.
And because God bless me every day, just tell me your feeling. Oh, anytime they hear my song, they say I'm amazing. And the people who them know say we see baby bad and say I'm the baddest. And some people think say them bad past me, but nobody badder. And any party where I go, I mash up the place and turn up the feeling.
I want your body sleeping in my bed. I want your body sleeping in my bed. You got me going crazy.
Follow me, Eleni. We see Eleni. Okumola Eleni. Akade Eleni. Pashala Eleni. Tinubu Eleni. Matakala Eleni. Ah, we see Eleni.
Arresting on the microphone, we know say you must to dance. I'm on my way.
Pity, pity, pity,
money. Baby, come and rock my body. Baby, come and chop my money. Where we go?
Music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. It's now time for commentary and analysis by Dr. Suleiman Yang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Yang.
Hello, Africa. It's always a pleasure for me to share my reflections with the audience of the Voice of America. Every week, I pay close attention to the headlines regarding U.S. policy towards Africa. I also pay simultaneously attention to African opinions on and attitudes toward the United States. This week, I want to really focus on term limits, the ongoing debates in Africa, and the American experience. Then I want to focus briefly on presidential actions in Africa regarding human rights in various African countries and the consequences of their action. Then finally, human rights violations and the World Court in African affairs. If you go back to the question of term limits, you can see that since the time of independence, when Kwame Nkrumah led the African countries towards independence, the African leaders and all the scholars who were looking at African affairs at that time were very much concerned about state building and nation building in Africa. In the particular case of Ghana, some of the African political scientists, like David Apter, wrote a book called Transition in Gold Coast or Ghana, as we later know it. And there were the question of charismatic leadership and the manner in which power is transferred from Europeans to African heads. The Africans in Ghana were concerned about democracy and political participation. So the multi-party system started in Ghana, and then the question of term limits was quickly put away when a one-party dictatorship was established. Today, many years later in Africa, as we move in the 21st century, the question of term limits, as developed in American political history, is becoming more and more relevant in African political history. Term limits have become important because the African decision to move away from one-party dictatorship to a presidential government with time limits for the president is becoming more and more real in Senegal, in Ghana, in Gambia, in Botswana, Namibia, and the list growing bigger and bigger. But many other African states are yet to be included in the list. Presidential action and their consequences in Africa. Again, you can go back to Ghana, and you start at the point of departure with Kwame Nkrumah. When the political opposition became very vocal against Kwame Nkrumah. Not only did the Ghanaians have a one-party dictatorship, and that one-party dictatorship was duplicated across Africa. Almost all African countries, except Nigeria, had a one-party dictatorship after independence. But gradually, by 1975, people like Leopold Senghor of Senegal and Julius Nyerere of Tanzania began to move away from the one-party dictatorship, and they began to establish multi-party politics. And this has implications for presidential action and their consequences of it. So once people like Senghor decided to move Senegalese society forward, political system, with room for the opposition, we began to see a shift in the paradigm of Senegalese politics. And this shift led to the resignation of Senghor as president, which was followed by Julius Nyerere and Chaka Stephen Sierra Leone and the president of Cameroon, Ahmadou Ahidjo. So they became the pioneers of African leaders who left office voluntarily and you have a new ball game in those societies. And of course, the Americans were watching them closely and see what was beginning to happen in these African countries. But the problem would be muddied by the liberation groups. Once these African countries fighting against Portuguese or settler colonialism become independent, the leaders of these countries continue the practice that goes back to Kwame Nkrumah with one-party dictatorship. The Party of Liberation becomes the dominant party in the society. It happened in Zimbabwe. It happened in Namibia. And then, of course, even when South Africa became independent, you have the dominant Party of Liberation controlling the government. So this creates a problem with regard to presidential action and their consequences. The most clear example is Zimbabwe, where President Mugabe has been there since independence, and like Kwame Nkrumah, Sekou Toure, Modibo Keita, Senghor, Nyerere, and others, because they were the leaders of liberation, they continue to be the dominant party, and until the United States and many other governments began to put pressure for pluralism to be developed in politics, we can see how in Zimbabwe you have presidential action and their consequences blatantly clear at the recent meeting of the African Union in South Africa, when President Mugabe, after a long term in office, became the chairman of the African Union and became a bone of contention among many Africans as to presidential action and their consequences, because some of these leaders stay in power beyond 30 years or 20 years, and this creates a problem in many African countries. Now, you move to the last issue, human rights violation in the World Court. You can see how the political evolution of African societies since independence takes different turns and twists. Liberia, which has been a pioneer in terms of being an independent African country going back to the 19th century, when Liberia became an independent country of free blacks from the United States, and of course, a party dominated that society until the time of Tubman and Tolbert. And then, of course, you have a military coup d'etat on Samuel Doe. And that changed the whole narrative in Liberia. And that created also many other precedents of political violence. The violence in Liberia and then in Sierra Leone created a new political situation in Africa. And this is where human rights violations became very critical. And of course, there were human rights violations in the Congo with Lumumba and the loss of power by the ruling party of Mouma National Congolese of Lumumba and the Conrad party of Kasavubu. And then, of course, military coup d'etat on the Mobutu that also changed the narrative in the Congo. And human rights violations became a perennial question. To conclude this narrative, one can say that when you look at U.S. policy towards Africa and you look at African opinions on and attitudes toward the U.S., these three issues of term limits, presidential action and their consequences, and human rights violations and the action of the World Court are going to be ongoing in subsequent lectures or presentation by me or any other person who is looking at Africa. That's the way it is today. What is going on?
Thank you very much, Dr. Nyang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, John Dryden, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. I remember, as the elders say, one who has been bitten by a snake lives in fear of worms. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Director Dan Ash recently announced a final rule to classify all chimpanzees, both wild and captive, as endangered under the Endangered Species Act, or ESA. The rule upgrades the status of captive chimpanzees from threatened to match that of wild chimpanzees and removes them from a special rule for primates that allowed some activities otherwise prohibited under the ESA. Threats to the chimpanzee, including habitat loss, poaching, and disease, have intensified and expanded since wild populations were listed as endangered in 1990. These threats are exacerbated by an increasing human population, the expansion of settlements, and increasing pressure on natural resources to meet the needs of the growing human population. The ESA does not allow for captive-held animals to be assigned separate legal status from their wild counterparts on the basis of their captive state. Chimpanzees are found in a wide but discontinuous distribution in 22 countries of equatorial Africa. Across the range of the species, high deforestation rates are destroying and fragmenting forests. Widespread poaching, capture for the pet trade, and outbreaks of disease are impeding chimpanzees' ability to sustain viable populations in the wild. The Fish and Wildlife Service has funded $9.4 million in grants for conservation efforts to protect chimpanzees, matched by an additional $11.5 million in leverage funds. These grants have supported field projects in 19 countries. The service will work closely with the biomedical research community to permit biomedical research that must use chimpanzees as research subjects. The final rule will publish in the Federal Register on June 16, 2015, and will go into effect 90 days after publication on September 14, 2015. Extending captive chimpanzees the protections afforded their endangered cousins in the wild will ensure humane treatment and restrict commercial activities under the Endangered Species Act, said U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Director Ash. The decision responds to growing threats to the species and aligns the chimpanzee's status with existing legal requirements. Meanwhile, we will continue to work with range states to ensure the continued survival and recovery of chimpanzees in the wild.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.